got to know parts of Ghana on the way, and mm-hmm. then spent some time there on their compound. It's 3 acres of land. And it's just, it looks like paradise. Like if I was to say, draw me a picture of paradise, it looks just like this place.
Wow.
It's stunning. Absolutely stunning. Yeah, the Seta Buddha house, because they have the big rock.
This is The Conversation. It's episode 186 with Lisa Soto. She is a Los Angeles-based artist, though really as much a global child artist. That is, she is comfortable elsewhere, on the road, traveling for 3 month stints, as she is at home, wherever that may be. More on that soon. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of Lisa in Ghana, one of the places she spent a lot of time, and as well her work, her installation work, including one in the Abbey Hotel in Miami. And let's see, what else can I tell you? For you fans of the process-based, that is, artist-making type of conversation, this is definitely for you, although there's much more abstract stuff that is covered as well, so look forward to that. I'm going to talk to you a little bit, one more time, about Dana Schutz, the infamous painter involved in the Whitney Biennial right now. Since I've mentioned it before, I just want to do a final thought on that on the back end. And what else before we get into the show? We are at 186 now. We're going to be at 200 before we know it. So if you guys have any things you want to contribute to maybe a listener-based 200th episode, anecdotes, thoughts about past episodes, what have you, I'd love to hear from you. So let's give it a try. I'll put that word out there, see what you guys have to say, see if you have anything you want to share, anything at all, and maybe we can put a group of those together for the 200th. So just putting that out there as an idea. Be more interesting than just having another guest, wouldn't it? So it's up to you guys. All right. Without further ado, let's get to the conversation with Lisa. Thank you guys very much for being here. Stay tuned for the back end, and I'll tell you about Dana Schutz and more. Talk to you then. So the first thing I was going to ask you about anyway, and I was thinking about asking you before, but I'll just ask you now, is wasn't yesterday your big Claremont presentation?
I love that you said my big. It was really...
Was it not big?
Well... I wouldn't consider it big. I've had larger audiences.
Oh, I just meant, yeah, right. I didn't mean literally in terms of the number of people so much as that when we spoke on the phone, it was something that was coming up. And
Yeah. I was really excited about it, and it turned out to be really lovely. I love speaking with students. And I know how vulnerable it feels as an artist to have people come into your studio and look around and ask lots of questions and challenge you in some ways, because that's what you're there for, is to give some new ideas and perspective.
Yeah.
So I felt really privileged that all of the artists had chosen me, which is really
sweet.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
And it's a painting school. You know, it's primarily a painting school. Obviously, they do a range of mediums there, but... it's known for that. And I started off as a painter, so I was able to speak that language as well. But then come from my perspective as an installation and sculptor. So,
where did you get on their radar, do you think?
A couple of students there knew about me and have been following me for a while. So,
that's nice to learn, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where had they learned about you, do you think? And as my own preface, that you had been doing this conversation series with other artists, right? So that's one way that people have heard about mm-hmm. you. But I mean, I hadn't heard about you from your art, you know, not mm-hmm. that I know about everything that's going on, but mm-hmm. I just wonder when other people are more, you know, are in tune to a certain radar, like where that comes from.
I didn't ask them directly.
Right.
I've done a number of shows in LA that they would have known about, and mm-hmm. Instagram, I think, is a big one too.
Oh, you're a big Instagram user. Okay. How long have you been on it?
Oh,
you don't mind my asking.
I don't know. I never thought about that.
Like,
I guess a couple years.
Couple years? Okay.
I feel like that. It could be longer.
The reason I ask is because it seems I'm just like a little over maybe a year and a couple months or something like that, roughly. And I just noticed that some artists who have substantial followings, my sense is, particularly ones who are from the Bay Area, you know, and I imagine that the Bay Area people got on it like a long time ago. Okay. And so they've been able to build up over time. That's why I asked. So.
Oh, I see. Anyway. No, I don't know. But I do prefer Instagram to Facebook.
I do too. Mm. High five. Yeah.
But I just find Facebook to get clogged up. I think that's the part of it that just is unappealing to me. And I like Instagram because it's clean. It's visual. It's really specifically visual.
Yeah.
And I'm following some lovely Instagram sites where, from friends to National Geographic, that really inspire me.
Mm.
That are traveling around the world and
right.
showing me what they see, and that's really interesting to me. And learning about the universe, I'm kind of science geek, you know, like I kind of get into all that stuff. So I really enjoy looking at pictures of the nebulae and...
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting to me. So when it gets into the political realm and to my dog ate this today type thing on Facebook, I sort of turn off. I rather have political discussions in person personally, though with this era... Let's just say this new era, Facebook has become more interesting because there are so many interesting articles coming out about the assumed demise of our country. So it's interesting in that way. But the discussions sometimes go far off, you know, into a personal realm, and there's a lot of anger and a lot of angst. And that's the part that I don't like about Facebook. I see people's hiding behind this, you know, social network and venting their angst and their personal anxieties and anger, real anger, when it should be a healthy discussion about what we feel and what's going on in our community and how we can make things better.
Right, right. But you still find yourself on there inevitably just because you kind of have to keep up with certain things.
Yeah. It's a useful tool. There's no question about it. Yeah, I can't deny that.
Keeping people updated on your travels and whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what is your email handle that has to do with travel?
My email address?
Yeah.
Global Child?
Yeah, Global Child. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, because I was thinking of that as you were talking about, you know, Instagram and the travel.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like, you're not constantly, but you're often on the move. Right?
It's my rhythm.
It's your rhythm, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Do you feel stuck when you're, like, in L.A. for a certain amount of time? Do you feel stuck, though, when you go abroad? For how long does it take for you to feel kind of restless when you go abroad?
When I'm on the move? I mean, I usually if I travel for long periods, it's usually 3 months. That ends up to be what it is, 3 months. It's usually... how long I'm away for.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes four. I was living back and forth between Berlin and New York. And so I haven't stayed. I can stay a lot longer abroad without feeling itchy. Those itchy feet, you know.
Yeah.
Than when I'm here in the States.
Why do you think that is?
One of the reasons is because in the States, I feel isolated. And when I go abroad, because when I go abroad, I start finding out about the world. I know, even if I'm in London, I know what's happening in Ghana, for example. And here, I don't hear anything about Ghana unless I'm on my social media that am connected to those sites. But just out there, you realize that we're really in a bubble in the States overall. I mean, New York is a bit better, but even New York can feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
And when I leave and I go anywhere from, it doesn't matter if I go to London or Morocco or even the islands, the Caribbean islands where my family's from, I just feel more part of the world. I feel like I'm part of the entire world when I leave the States. So when I come back to the States, I feel isolated from the world.
Right. So is it the actual people, the international or the cosmopolitan mix of cultures, like in Europe, for example, like in London you mentioned, or Berlin, that you're coming into contact with? Or is there something about the dissemination of information too?
That's what it is.
Really?
Yes.
How is that?
I definitely feel that our media is just, we'd rather talk about the Kardashians than something that, you know, than some amazing thing that's happening in Accra or in Lagos or, you know, it's very frustrating. And our education system is not, I mean, women in the salons, hair salons in London are talking about artists. They may be famous, you know, they're definitely like, it may be Damien Hirst or whoever, but they're at least talking, they know.
Oh, I see, right.
They know who these people are, know who the artists are, they know what's going on, they're interested, they're gossiping about it, whatever it may be, but there is an interaction from, it's not here, it's just the art world talks about the art world, and outside of the art world, no one talks about the art world. And so
they talk about pop culture,
yeah. Exactly.
And the worst part of pop culture. That's exactly what I was thinking. Oh gosh, that's horrible.
Yeah. So I just feel more connected when I'm outside of the States.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is it for practical reasons then that you kind of have to come back here essentially?
Yeah. How would you put that? I've been trying to figure that out.
Yeah.
Like, why do I keep coming back? I mean, one is because for some reason I don't have another passport, even though I call myself a global child. Though I grew up in the south of Spain, my parents never got us another passport. So
3 months is kind of your limit?
So 3 months is my limit in terms of, I mean, I end up traveling longer sometimes, but 3 months is my rhythm.
Right.
That's more specific. That's really what it is. And I think it's because after we moved back from Spain, after spending 5 years there, back to New York, we went literally the day that school was out. We went home to eat, change, and got on a plane to Spain. And we're there for 3 months because that was the time when you could have your vacations, your summer vacations were 3 months. So we would come back a couple days before school. So we were there for a full 3 months every year till I was 18. So that's just turned into my rhythm. And I noticed that's inadvertently what happens. It just turns into, I get a residency in Dominican Republic, for example, this is years ago, mm-hmm. and it was for 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Or I go to Morocco and I end up being there for 3.5 months. It just ends up being around three. So it's not so much the limitations of my passport and visa issues so much as my natural rhythm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And are most of these 3 months, let's say, sometimes less, visits, sojourns, whatever you want to call them, are they often residencies?
No.
Okay. What are they? Just travel?
They're travel. They're me trying to find out more about the world.
Right. Okay.
And gather more information for my work.
Oh, okay.
So they're like research projects.
Right.
And combined with seeing my friends and my, you know, quote unquote families, have kind of tribes, I call them,
mm-hmm,
all
mm-hmm.
over.
Right.
So I go back to see my tribes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I just, it's like going back to school when I travel. I just learn so much in such a short amount of time. It's really nurturing and it's actually just educational.
Right.
Yeah.
So I imagine people are wondering how you would facilitate that depth of travel, right?
In what capacity?
Well, financially, perhaps.
So financially,
if you don't mind my broaching that?
I've been asked this many times.
Yeah.
So the first thing is I rent out my place, wherever I live, and I go, when I travel, I usually stay with friends or have places to stay.
Yeah.
So I'm not paying rent anymore.
Right.
So it becomes cheaper.
Right.
Right away.
Mm-hmm.
I use miles. I make sure I have a credit card that accrues miles. That's really important for me because it allows me to move around. And if I'm going to have a credit card, then it needs to be useful in that way. And then I max out my credit cards as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of wonderful, generous friends that, you know, feed me and house me, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you're a beloved individual by your by your world community.
I do the same for them when they come and visit me.
Oh, that's nice.
It's a nice exchange.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Why don't you tell us or we talk about your this living situation you do have here, since we talked about that a little bit, you know, on our phone call, which is that you live, I'll just introduce it by saying you live on the compound, for lack of better expression, of the artist Lita Albuquerque.
That's right.
So I guess I first want to ask you how that relationship, that mentorship, as you called it before, how that became a, you know, that close, I guess.
Well, that happened over time. The curator and friend of mine, Yael Lipschutz, and I were at a party for Nana Gana, who was featuring her new movie on women in LA, which was really beautiful, at this fashion photographer's house, Philip, in Venice Beach. And Yael actually saw her first, Lita, and said, "Who is that woman?" And I looked at her, I was like, "Wow, she's amazing." I said, "I have no idea." So we both looked at each other like, "Let's meet her." So really, we were like, we went up to her like groupies, even not knowing who she was,
right.
And then found out who she was,
right.
You know. But that's really because she just has this beautiful expression, and she just looks more like a spirit than a body. I mean, she really has this powerful, energetic realm around her all the time, beaming out from her core, and that's kind of how I see her. And a lot of people, as I've spoken to them, see her in a very similar way. They see her more as a walking spirit, an energy in motion,
wow,
than a body. So that's really how we met, and we just became friends over time. But it was immediate; we all clicked, you know. We all sensed each other's energetic realms and vibrations and got it and felt comfortable and felt like there was more to learn. And so we just became friends over time, and then we became very close friends. And I really admire her work and her vision in her work that she's been putting out there for a long time. And I really do think it's part of what they've talked about is like what might be coming next is the age of wisdom for, you know, so we're in these different ages, right? Industrial age and information age. And
right.
So
the technology age, is that what's
going on? Technology age is what we're in now.
Okay. So the age of wisdom is maybe what's coming next.
The age of wisdom is maybe what's coming next. And I feel that her work, what she's been talking about, and a lot of, the themes and concepts in my work as well that I've been hashing out over time is in conjunction with this possible age of wisdom. And so I've kind of taken her on as a mentor as well, you know, to kind of teach
and
me.
And she
to
obviously
think
in addition to you being drawn to her, she was somewhat, she reciprocated to a certain degree.
There's some similarities, how we were actually both born in LA, but then our childhood was spent outside. So for her, she spent in Tunisia and in Paris and went to school there, and I went to school in the south of Spain, across the waters from Morocco. So I was across the waters from North Africa. She grew up in North Africa, you know. And then our travels are similar, and our tastes are similar, what we're attracted to in this world is very similar. So we have a lot of discussions on these things.
Like international things, international cultures,
yes,
for example.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. This was something that you mentioned in passing when we spoke on the phone, and in describing Lita, you are talking about this spirit, you know, and so on. And you referred to energy, and that seems to be something that's a important part of the way that you interact with the world. And I just wonder, I guess, as a way of starting to talk about that, if this fits into a particular belief system, or more of a scientific thing, or a combination of both, you know, for you?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a combination of both. On the personal side, my mother has that sixth sense, right? That intuition. And my grandmother, her mother had it too, where they can just read people. They can read people's energy. And as a child, I could read people's energy kind of like a ticker tape. I could see what was going on, moving through their system and where that came from and perhaps the reasons behind them. It's harder now because my head is full, and as you get older, you become more ego. And right. When you're a child, you're less ego.
Right.
You know? So I was more empty before, so I could see better, and I could read better. But I'm still paying attention to that part of me so that I can still continue to read. And we all can. I mean, we all do it all the time without realizing. For example, you walk into a room, and if it feels bad, you're like, I'm getting out of here. This does not feel good. There's no reason. Everybody's cool, whatever. The music might be all right. But you feel something's wrong. That's all we're talking about here. It's just magnetized by what your sensitivity level.
There's some galleries I find it very much fit into that category.
It's a whole nother round to talk about.
Well, would you, in spite of the fact that you don't have the expert practitioner that you were, you know, when you were younger,
would you
indulge me with a brief reading just to see if anything comes up? I'm curious.
Oh, I couldn't do that on the...
not on recording?
Online. No, and I have to experience it and then reflect on it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
got it. It's not
works.
An instantaneous kind of thing, nope. Unless it's like overtly one way or the other.
No, I'd always have to experience it, even if it's, I mean, yes, if you feel like, oh, I have to get away from here, but you don't know why.
Okay.
That's just, you just do it. So that's an experience.
Okay.
The reflection part has to come later. And it usually comes through imagery, not through words so much.
Okay. Well, here's maybe what I'm thinking. I was going to say, well, maybe long after you've left, you know, you can, but since you just said the imagery, maybe you can give me a couple of images that come up a week, and that can be part of your portfolio of
okay,
work.
I'll let you know. Okay. I'll let you know.
Not putting you on the spot or anything.
Well, it's just that it's too early.
Yeah.
Because I'm in the middle of reading, quote unquote.
Oh, yeah, right. Just, yeah. And you've got, speaking of your head being full, I mean, you know, well, this is, I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts are about this, because there may be some crossover with what you're talking about in terms of taking things in or somebody in, you know, and then reflecting on it, mm-hmm. is that what I found in doing these conversations, mm-hmm. is regardless of the fact that I'm, you know, presumably getting better at it, having done it for several years, is that I am so full when I'm in the middle of a conversation that I have to go on autopilot to a certain extent.
Mm.
And when I listen back, when I'm editing, it's then that I can actually kind of appreciate the conversation, because mm-hmm. There's just too much to juggle.
Yes.
In the moment.
Yes, makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's some crossover there.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Okay. Well, so getting back to then your living situation, and you know, you can tell me if it's getting too pedantic or whatever, but I mean, because of this travel lifestyle that you have, are you renting from her and then you rent to people on her compound, or how does that work, if you don't mind my asking?
No, so this was simply me. I had given up my place in July because I was going to Ghana and New York and London, D.C. I had a whole kind of tour, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And then ending up again in Ghana in October. So for 4 months I was traveling. So when I went to Miami. And then when I returned, before I returned, she said, you can stay with us while you find a place. And then I was supposed to get a place in January. So it was only meant to be for a few weeks. And the place I was meant to get kept being delayed because they were renovating. And by the time it was available, which was only recently, like last week, I realized that the rest of this year I'll be traveling a lot. And I'll probably only be here for 3, maybe 4 months max out of the rest of this year.
Mm.
And Lita and I have found a real, again, I use the word rhythm, like a very natural rhythm between us living together. I am living in a different structure, so I'm not living in the house with her and her husband, so there's some space. But it's been we've just starting to have a ritual, like we're creating a ritual now, and it's been really, really lovely, and something you couldn't even try to make happen. Either happens or it doesn't, you know. And so mm-hmm. it's been very comfortable. They've been really generous, and we really feed off of each other. And so we wanted to continue that.
What is part of the, what? Can you say more about the ritual?
Well, I make breakfast every morning, so that's one of our rituals. I mean, really, I make this special shake with all this goodness in it, and
a green heavy shake. Are we talking about, or
it's not green, but yes, it's a protein heavy shake.
Okay,
and it's got lots of yummy, wonderful stuff in it, like maca and Shishandra berry and all this yumminess. Yes, that's just going to nutrify.
Where's the Shishandra berry from?
I buy everything from Moon Juice, personally.
Okay.
But you can get Shishandra berry powder or the Shishandra berry itself. You just need to eat a lot more of that. But that's an ancient berry that they've been using since the tribes of in Russia and in China, you know, before it was Russia and China.
I just heard about this berry. I don't think it's that one, but it grows in Scandinavia by the coast. Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to have, you know, one little berry is supposed to have, you know, more vitamin C than mm-hmm. you could ever need in a day or something like
right.
that.
Right. Shishandra is something
similar,
and it gives you energy, but it calms your system. So hunters would use it because it would give them enough energy to hunt for a few days, but not make them, not stoke their adrenaline. So it actually calms their adrenaline system
mm-hmm.
and makes them more clear and more focused. So the tribes in Russia and in China used to use this for their hunting days. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. We're not exactly hunting, but sometimes you just feel like you need that extra boost with all of the poisons that are being kind of distributed through our waters and our
That's such a great
air.
Image. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just the episode that I'm editing now to put out soon is with this woman who, an artist in San Francisco, who works with comedy a lot. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about the language of comedy, you know, which includes, it has this sort of very brutalizing kind of imagery. Like, you know, you're like killing your audience, you're defeating them, you know what I mean? And I like the that awareness that a lot of time you're going out into the world as a warrior,
mm-hmm.
even if it's in a very social way mm-hmm. rather than an actual way.
Yeah, it's becoming more and more like that. It's kind of, that's a whole nother conversation. I don't want to go too far.
Sure. We're not about super long tangents here, so that's okay. Yeah. Well, but getting back to the energy thing, one of the things that I was thinking about as you were talking about the ritual and whatnot is wondering where, because as you say, you're sort of filled up now, you don't have the emptiness that you did when you were younger. So how does that evolve then? I mean, does that pursuit or that ability get almost completely eclipsed by just the needs of, you know, career survival and whatnot? Or, you know what I mean? Has it evolved into something different since then?
I have to be more intentional now. So I meditate. That's a big one. Mm-hmm. I meditate and I'm aware of my exchange of energy. But I have to be purposeful now. And before it was more of a natural flow. So
right.
I have to continuously unblock my blockages.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like being a kid and, you know, being able to run and not getting sore
mm-hmm.
and whatnot. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, sore all the time. Well, regarding some of the travel that you have been doing and are doing, you mentioned Ghana. And I think when we were on the phone, you mentioned Namibia mm-hmm. as well, right?
Oh, I might be. Yeah,
you might be. Okay. Mm-hmm. So is Africa one of the regular places that you travel to?
It's becoming so.
Okay. How did that start and how is that continuing?
Well, it started actually quite interestingly by a friend of mine, Jamal, who's a young artist, Jamal Tolbert. He is friends with Todd and Kuhn Mee. Todd Gray and Kuhn Mee Shin are both artists. They're an artist couple. And they have a place in Ghana. So I knew Todd, but I didn't know about the place. And Jamal told me, and he was supposed to go with another friend, and they weren't able to go at the same time. And it was around the time of my birthday last year. So I was like, well, maybe I'll go for my birthday. And he's like, oh, no, you're going. That's it. It's done. And I'm like, wait, I haven't thought it through. He's like, no. So Todd and Kuhn Me, it's a long story about how they acquired their space. But basically, they bought land and built a mud house on this property in front of the ocean in the western region of Ghana 10 years ago. And they haven't been going a lot in the last few years. They've been going to other places, including South Africa. So they have started to allow friends of theirs to use it as an artist residency space. So they are now doing it in such a way that you write a proposal about what you would do, and they have two people on the grounds who are, you know, the keepers of the grounds, and so they're there when you're there, and they're wonderful, Yankee and Samson, and Yankee, Rasta. He's a Rasta, Ghanaian Rasta.
Okay.
Yeah, he turned Rasta. Which is really cool. So he's like, he cuts the coconut every morning. I get my coconut water, and you know, and I learned so much from Yankee. He really knows the land and the landscape. And we go through long walks for hours, and he shows me the berries or the traps for the bush meat. Or, I mean, it's just amazing. The rocks and the secret beaches. And anyway, it's such an incredible experience. It's such a beautiful country. And it really, for me personally, it reminds me of Jamaica, which is where my father's family comes from. But it's like, if you had blindfolded me and beamed me over there, I would have thought we were in a part of Jamaica that I didn't know.
Oh, wow.
So it really is, it has this whole, and parts of it look like Puerto Rico, which is where my mother's side of the family is from. It just feels like home. That's what it comes down to.
I see.
Even though I didn't grow up in the islands, I only went there as an adult, but my mom has been in Puerto Rico for 25 years now. I just fell in love with Ghana. And so that was the opportunity to go, was to do this residency. So we traveled a bit on the way, because it's about 5 hours from the capital, and got to know parts of Ghana on the way, and then spent some time there on their compound. It's 3 acres of land, and it's just, it looks like paradise. Like, if I was to say, draw me a picture of paradise, it looks just like this place.
Wow.
It's stunning. Absolutely stunning. Yeah, the Seta Buddha house, because they have the big rocks in the front of, in the water, in the ocean there, that they call Seta Buddha, and the spirits that live there, apparently, from a boat crash. Yeah. So I went back in October and did a talk at the University of Kumasi, because my friend Godfrey Dunker, who's an incredible artist based in London, is from Ghana, and he arranged for that for me and introduced me to the students there, and he's been teaching on and off there for 10 years. And that was incredible experience to meet the students. And again, it was, you know, similar to like yesterday, interacting with the students, doing a bit of studio visits, doing a lecture. I mean, there was over 300 students at 10 in the morning to come see me speak. And
that's incredible.
Al Anatsui had spoken the week before, so I was part of that program. So that was really quite something. And then I went to the Kente village outside of Kumasi to get the Kente cloth. So it's just I can't wait to go back. I'm going back in August for the month.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And how would you describe being an artist, or, you know, the art community, if only through that school that you visited, you know, as compared to what we are more familiar with in the art capitals or what have you, you know what I mean?
It's pretty similar. I mean,
is
an artist, I mean, they have other departments, but that's in, you know, they have a very, very strong art department. Some of their biggest artists come out of that school, that university. And in Accra, the capital, it's got a burgeoning scene of artists. I mean, they still need time to really grow and work without the commerce coming in and overriding and stumping their growth. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably true for most places,
right?
To be honest. But it's a mixture of music and fashion and art, and all kinds of arts. that a growing community interacting, you know, they're really they're overlapping, as opposed to the States where everything is always so separated into categories. Even our radio stations are separated into categories of rock station, jazz station. That's not actually the case in a lot of other parts of the world.
Right.
They mix it all up. It's about good music and what follows what, you know, in a sonic way that makes sense.
Right.
Not about these categories.
Yeah.
So there is this incredible community in Accra. And there's a new center, Ano Center, that just started by Nana Ofadiata. She's amazing curator, young curator and educator and historian. And she's really documenting the African, she's really going through the whole continent and really doing a lot of documentation on the history of African art in all the different countries and cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going on in Accra right now. That just opened. You know, there's 1957, the gallery at the Kempinski Hotel. I think it's incredible what's happening there. There's so many aspects that you're never bored, and it's always growing and changing. And there's a wonderful relationship between Lagos, the artists in Lagos, and the artists in Ghana, and in Accra specifically, but also Kumasi. So it's very rich and it's very contemporary, and I can't get enough of it.
Would you move there if you had the opportunity?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
So what are the practical barriers? I mean, like in other countries, you have to be married to a resident, or
I don't know. I'm going to go in August to kind of research this. I think that it's much easier to get a passport there or to live there as a resident, but I have to investigate that further.
Mm-hmm.
I have still a lot of commitments in LA this year and next year, so that's another barrier for me right now in terms of getting up and going, because I still need to be here, and it's still good for me to be here, and I do love LA as well. I have to, as much as I will complain about it, I really do love LA.
I like and to I complain love, about it too.
Yeah. So that's like that love, right? When you love something, you start complaining and bitching about
it.
It's an odd way.
Well, one of the things that I was thinking as you were talking about Ghana is, and I wonder how much this applies to the other countries that you go to or have been to, is you're talking about a different speed of life. And I wonder if that's like one of the big draws as well.
Absolutely.
Being able to, I mean, just because, I mean, one of the things that about LA is that is such a paradox is that you have all these natural, you know, lovely natural resources, but they just sit there unused, untapped. Mm-hmm. That's what I find, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I live not that far from the ocean, but how often do I go? You know what I mean? But when you're in Ghana or when you're in one of these other places, I mean, maybe it's because you get into a vacation mindset. I don't know how much of that is a factor, but you're just kind of in it, you know what I mean? And here, you're close, but you're not in it.
I like that. I hadn't thought about it that way, but you're right. It's a natural interaction. It's a natural part of your flow in your day to use and be, in all those areas. I don't know what it's like to live there, so maybe it would be different, but we'll see.
I mean, there is obviously that, that sentiment or that understanding that the places that we visit for a finite amount of time, you know, are the most attractive to us because we don't wear out our welcome.
Exactly. Yeah, there's always that.
Right.
And I never am comfortable staying in one place all year round anyway.
Right.
So I always need to do my 3-month sabbatical somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So before we started recording, we briefly talked about, in addition to this talk that you gave yesterday, that you had a bunch of projects going on, and you said that it was terrifying. So I'm interested in hearing more about that. How is it hitting you that way?
It's been a very busy year, with new projects I had to learn a lot of things while accomplishing these goals, in a short amount of time. And it's overwhelming, you know, and it's terrifying because it's not just about trying to get a lot of things done. It's about doing it well. That's really a concern for me, you know. It's not quantity. It's definitely quality that I'm interested in. And I didn't want to, well, we never want to fail. Or at least if I'm going to fail, it should be in an interesting way. So this year has been quite something. And it's exciting at the same time. So the things, I've done a bunch of things that I, my brain is just not going to remember what I've done in the last 4 months. But what's coming up is a show at the Craft and Folk Art Museum in May, at the end of May.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a group show that's opening, and I have an installation that I'll be putting in there. And it's at the same time as Betty Starr's solo show in the building. So that's really exciting to me, actually. So I have that coming, but I'm going to New York to see the 154 African Art Fair at the same time as the Frieze, London Frieze Art Fair that's in New York at Randall's Island.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to that, New York in end of this month, and then go to Venice for the opening of the biennial, and then go to Athens to see that part of Documenta. And then I come back and I install at the Museum of Craft and Folk Art. And I also have a show coming up at MOLA, through PSTLALA, so the Museum of Latin American Art.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be doing my first public art installation. So that's been pretty, that's part of the terrifying part.
Right, yeah.
That's part of the terrifying, number of projects that I'm doing. So that will be in Newark, New Jersey, and I'm installing in October after working on this for about 2 years.
But these things coming up in New York and Europe, you're going as a viewer,
I'm
right?
I'm going as a viewer.
Yeah.
I'm going as a viewer. I also have meetings.
Okay.
Yeah. I have meetings in New York regarding the public art. I have a meeting.
Where is the public art going to be?
In Newark, New Jersey.
Newark, New Jersey, right. Okay. Mm-hmm. And did you apply amongst a bunch of other people and got it? Or
No. It was a natural flow. I was just having drinks with my friend David Ajay, who's an architect, and
the big name architect. Sorry. I know. I was like, oh, I recognize that name.
Right. So yeah. He did the Smithsonian, the African American History and Culture Museum, recently. So
yeah.
He's most known in the States for that. Although he's done, he has an incredible body of work
throughout
the world,
right.
The entire world, which is so impressive that Americans still are not up to par on, but they're becoming such. So we just, a couple years ago, we were just catching up. Hadn't seen each other in a minute. And I was just...
Did you know him from London?
I actually did meet him in London about 10 years ago. So we've known each other for a long time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I just... Somehow this project came up. I said something about wanting to do a project in New York, you know, so I can be in New York more. And he had just come from a meeting about this very special project in Newark, New Jersey, in the Fairmont neighborhood, where they're putting in this power station. They were trying to build this power station in some part of Newark, and it landed in a poor black neighborhood, of course. So the Urban League really fought it and got the attention of the mayor, which made him at least negotiate with them in such a way that they would still leave it. They still built it there in the end, but they allowed them to bring David in. So they looked for an architect. They found David. They brought him in. He always thinks out of the box and is always very considerate of the communities that he's building in, because that's the kind of architect that he is.
Mm.
And that's what they needed in this case. And so he wanted it to be artist-based or art-based.
Mm-hmm.
So the Aljara Contemporary Art Center, which I had done a residency with like 10 years ago or so, they were involved with bringing in the other artists. There's 14 artists altogether, and David brought me in, and I just happened to, it just happens to be Aljira, so I was already connected, so it was really a perfect, because I'm the only one that's not in New York.
Right.
They really wanted it to be more local-based artists. So half are from Newark, New Jersey, and half are from Brooklyn. So there's some wonderful artists involved. And I will be doing this outdoor permanent installation that I refer to as my force field. Mm-hmm. It's not the title, but it's the type of work that I'll be going into from this point on, if all goes well.
Right.
Let's see if I can actually do this. You know,
yeah.
But I do envision these force fields and creating these force fields throughout communities that bring them together, lift them up, and protect them. A kind of anti-gentrification, but still beautification and mm-hmm. community-based mm-hmm. artwork.
Right, yeah. When you're making that piece, or, you know, which you obviously won't know until you do it, mm-hmm. but pieces that might be considered a predecessor to doing that, and you're and we talked about this briefly on the phone before, what, you know, this energy field, which is one of your big things, how much of that, making those, that kind of work or those kinds of pieces, is about your intention and or your state of mind as you're making it, if that makes sense?
Well, if I understand you correctly, I think my intention has to be really clear for it to work. And even the placement of each object, material, whatever I'm using, they have to be placed in the right place in order for the whole thing to be activated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I realized I realized that I've been doing this with my work, that that's what my work is about. They are energy fields. In the end, that's what all my work has been for the last 7-8 years, let's say. And I realized it in the most commercial manner of a hotel in Miami bought an installation from a show I had done previously. And when I was putting up, and they're just simple lines of wire with knots in them, but when I put that first line up, and I was with the owner of the hotel who had bought the piece, and we both looked at each other, we're like, yes, we just knew. And by the time I'd finished, it had completely changed the lobby, and it had created an energy field in the lobby.
Mm.
And you could tell because of people walking in, their reactions. Sometimes people would be so drawn, like so enamored by it or taken by it or just connected to it, they would physically jump back. And then they would be drawn to it and wouldn't stop looking at the piece. And even as people were checking in, they never looked at the guys at the counter, you know, who are checking them in. They were staring at the piece behind them.
Right.
There was a real visceral reaction to the public, you know, once they interacted with the piece. And that's when I realized this is what I've been doing all along.
That must have been very satisfying.
It's exciting.
Yeah.
It's really exciting.
And now, to use that piece as an example, when you look back on, you know, what went into making it, can you see, you know, what it was? I mean, I'm going to guess
it's really intentional.
Right, like, but when you make your decisions, though, in addition to the intention, is that intuitive?
Yes, I was just going to say exactly that. I'm like, I need to be open and let that part of me flow and interact and lead. If it's too much of the conceptual and the thinking and the, you know, I realize that if you were to try to change it a little, I will tell you all the reasons why you can't. So there's a lot of rationale behind it,
yeah.
I will admit.
Right.
But I have to work with both the intuition and the rationale. They have to be that balance back and forth.
Yeah.
They really are both equally important.
Yeah. Sometimes it's much easier to figure out what something isn't than what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you say it's definitely not that.
Right.
It's definitely not that.
That's true. Yes.
And I'm wondering too about what, as far as what goes into making that piece or pieces like it, is how much the doing the meditation, for example, informs, you know, that ability, that intention, because since you are so filled up with, as we've talked about, you know, all the things that go into, you know, having our child or our sort of open-mindedness taken over by closed-mindedness,
mm-hmm.
you know, that when you're doing the meditation, among other things, perhaps, that that's going to pay off when it comes to being open to that creation.
I mean, there's a couple of things. One is that I've gotten to the point where I can't make the work on my own, you know, just by myself. It takes too long. So I definitely have assistants working with me. So that's where I have to be very clear ahead of time. And then I have to explain it to them. So now it's no longer my energy, per se, going into those pieces.
Right.
Which at first made me nervous because I really felt that that was what made those pieces powerful or what made them valuable. But it actually is the intention behind it and then the choices that I make. So when I try not to be too rigid with them, but if they go off the, you know, the wrong end, so to speak, I explain to them why that doesn't work and what I'm trying. And that helps me understand what I'm actually doing and why I need it to be this way, because it leads to that. So there are a lot of those kind of rationale steps that still are interwoven with intuitive, and I need to be uber clear. Therefore, meditation is very important. Yes.
What's an example, if one comes to mind, of a of an instruction to an assistant, like as far as not what they shouldn't do, but what they what's an example of something they need to do?
Well, for example, we've been working on this piece for a couple of years. That's about 50 feet by 40 feet, and it's crocheted wire, and it's these rivers and rivers and rivers of crocheted wire. And they would, the first thing was like, I'm like, I need all your mistakes. Make lots of mistakes. Don't make this perfect. It'll be, it'll die if you make it. And then I started giving them forms and shapes to follow, to kind of mimic. And those shapes, I realized later, because I would say whether spider webs, for example, or eels, or like the sundials, but then look at this, and then I would show them images. And I realized that I've been looking at ancient Taino, which is what Puerto Ricans originally were, you know, the people, the indigenous people from my island. And we are, my family are Taino. And I've been looking at these symbols that the Tainos used to draw all the time, indicating the sun and the rivers and the different weathers and weather patterns and snakes and so on, just their environment. You know, there was all these symbols to describe them, their environment. And I've been, like, subconsciously coding all of my work with these Taino symbols in this abstract way, and I just sort of have them create that, you know, based on those symbols. So that's an instruction,
right?
And that's, but that energy is important, and those coded, that coded vocabulary is important to create what it is I want, you know, that that kind of energy field I want to have at the end.
So you had assimilated that symbol.
Yes.
And you maybe hadn't even realized it.
Exactly. Right. I realized it recently. But I kept, I mean, that's what I have around me, is the images and my reference images. And that was something I showed yesterday at the talk with Claremont, is I decided to show my work along with my references. Mm. Because my work is so abstract, it can really, you can come from so many angles of what this means and where did this come from, and without the explanations.
Right.
So I decided to go through my references and show them what either has inspired me or what I realize I've been making this whole time, and or what I've been taking pictures of over and over again for years and years. And so it's clearly in the work. And that really helps to understand the what my perspective is, because it seems so broad and so open and so, you know, it could be anything, but it's not. It's very specific, in fact.
Right. Okay, so we know, you know, among other things, that you have this public art piece, which is going to be challenging and scary.
Yes.
For obvious reasons. But what, and I sort of gave you a prompt about this before we recorded, what other challenges would you say you have going on or have had going on?
The challenge of doing new things interwoven with what I do, like writing, is a challenge for me. Simple as that. I have written some fellowships recently, and I hadn't ventured into fellowships before. I've done grants and I've done, you know, other applications, but nothing quite like this. And writing. And breaking through the barriers of my own fears of how well or how, you know, badly I write, was a real challenge because I had a deadline and I felt like I needed to learn how to write at the same time I'm trying to get this deadline done.
Mm-hmm.
And that was terrifying. And so what I've learned with these challenges is to recruit my team, my tribe, you know, look for people who are good at what I'm not good at and recruit their help. And it has helped, you know, I've had a wonderful team. You know, every project is different people that I would recruit. But just, I mean, it's just asking friends. Like, we seem to, you know, we tend to think as artists, we think we're supposed to do everything on our own. Hence, it's made us very able, you know. I mean, artists can build a house. There's so much that artists can do, you know, besides making art. There's all these other things because we're constantly learning and being curious, but also don't have money and so don't have resources and so we learn it ourselves.
Mm.
But sometimes it goes too far and you need to get help from people who actually do know so your expertise can grow exponentially and not just, you know, chug along. So I had to get myself to ask friends for help and who are excellent writers and great at editing and mm-hmm. helping me understand how I see how I write and where I go into a dead end and then how to get out of that. And so that's it's been wonderful, but of course challenging, as we've said. So.
Is the writing, though, as much about being great writing versus, we're talking about an application essentially, right?
We're talking about me being clear. And okay. And we're talking about me learning that language. Those, you know, the language of applications, the language of fellowship, the language of grant. It's a very specific language.
I think that's a skill that not many people have.
That. Right, exactly. I don't speak that language. Not well, anyway.
Right.
So I needed to be more precise. I need to be more clear. And it helped me be clear about my work as well, which was wonderful in
mm-hmm,
the end.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was, you know, cursing the whole time, but then it was great. At the end.
right. Well, what else then about this, other than the things you mentioned already, is terrifying about, you know, what's coming up? I mean, there's a lot of intensity, certainly. You know, there's a lot of business, which is probably going to be pretty exhausting,
that's
I would imagine.
That's another one. Business. I am not into finance and numbers and, yes, and contracts. So that's been quite a challenge.
Right. So for this public art project, for example, there's going to be a contract.
Yes, I'm dealing with the city, you know. So I've got David's office, thank God, you know, they're on my side and they're wonderful and extremely competent. But they're dealing with struggles and they need me to, you know, carry my weight. And contracts and all of that has been part of that conversation and that process. And I love working with people on a more instinctual basis of like, yep, we work well together, let's just keep going. And writing, you know, having a contract between us seems to muddle that purity that I feel, you know, we have established. So I had to get over that and start getting understanding of contracts and why they're important and what that language is and getting help for that, recruiting lawyers, recruiting another engineer here, you know, all of those aspects that were completely unbeknownst to me of how this works. So I've had to kind of grow up. I have to admit.
We're all doing that. As artists, we're doing that all very slowly.
Yes. I don't want to.
If at all.
No, I have to, so it's happening.
Right. Well, is there anything else? The thing that I feel like we haven't and we may not get further into is that you're interested in energy and chakras, as you mentioned mm-hmm. on the phone. And I don't really know if there's a easy way back in there, but is there anything else that comes to mind that you want to share about that?
That's a big one. I mean, that's just how I operate. It's how I understand.
Do you find any resistance from people, you know, when you share that kind of thing? Like, well, oh, it's so New Agey, California kind of thing?
I don't speak about it too much in that way because of that reaction.
Right.
It depends on who I'm talking to. Again, when I'm in the world and I speak about this, it's a lot easier. People get it. I feel Americans are more resistant or more
categorized. Oh, you mean when you're outside of America?
Yeah. I feel Americans can categorize it too much. Obviously, right. Not LA. LA is amazing. And I can have these conversations every day here and learn a lot, which is fantastic and I love. Going to New York, on the other hand, it's a little different.
Right.
I have to change my lingo.
That's a cliche that really holds up, doesn't it?
It's still there.
Yeah.
I have a lot of friends in New York that we discuss this openly and we all get each other. But I just have to phrase it differently. But it's really how I move through the world. It's how I understand the world and my environment. Everything is emitting energy all the time because everything is energy. And I'm interested in that and I can feel it. I'm connected to it. So I continue, and it's what I know.
Right.
I'm not really concerned with people's prejudices or fears about it. I would, other than to ease their fears about it, because it's just how we are as humans, is what makes us part of what makes us living creatures. And I really believe in science, and I am absolutely enthralled by the fact that we're on this spinning rock, you know, as a speck in this thing that we call the universe. Or Lakanea is the ancient Polynesian word. And we're finding through science more and more evidence that these, you know, kind of dreams and fairy tales and stories and hippie whatever conversations we're having are stemming from something that's quite factual. And I can't emphasize enough how important it is that we pay attention to the fact that we are part of this universe, and that this universe really does exist and it really does affect us. And if we can plug into it, we can reach our potential as humans and as beings, energetic beings, rather than be distracted by all the ugly conflicts that are kind of manifested by the powers that be.
Well, when you, I can't help but honor the thought that I had, which is, despite the fact that I don't necessarily want to go there, which is when you encounter somebody who maybe is, to put it very sort of diplomatically, is maybe less educated in the ways of the world and, you know, in a political sense, if you tend to pick up a different kind of energy there, usually.
Sure.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know.
Absolutely.
I just, one other thing I'd say about it is, as you were talking about that, I was thinking, I think there are a lot of people, and I can think of one person in particular in my life who I think would be really well served by accessing that language of energy, in addition to or combination with intuition, you know, as a way of making healthy decisions, as opposed to making harmful decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you could get out of certain situations, if nothing else, that you would not be well served by.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm gonna follow up with you about your energy reading post-reflection.
Okay.
Is there anything you would feel remiss that we haven't already? I mean, we could obviously go on, but for the purposes of this particular conversation.
I think we've done it.
It's been lovely talking with you.
It's been lovely being here. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And we're out. Thank you very much again to Lisa Soto for talking to me. And that was in the room, the same room that we spoke, as you probably gathered. Sorry, I didn't mention that at the beginning. And as far as the getting a report on my my energy quality, my energy field, I think if you have to ask, you can't afford it. That's what they say, isn't it? You have to ask about your energy field. You can't afford it. So I'll give you an update on that if anything comes from that. But I don't want to put her on the spot. And again, it's not something that she does the way that she did when she was younger. So thank you very much for being here. Before we go, and before I tell you about the Dana Schutz thing, I want to remind you this is a listener-supported show. Thank you very much to all of you on Patreon, which is not that many of you, and people who have donated recently via PayPal as well, including Patricia McEnroy. Thank you very much, and people who are fine not getting shout-outs. Thank you to all of you very much. And I really do encourage those of you who haven't donated to try Patreon. You can do it for just $1 a month. $3 would be a great starting point, though, because then you can get access to the bonus footage. And or to let you know, if you haven't heard, I just put out last weekend the most recent bonus episode, which is with Eric Yonker, that was recorded last December. Very, very witty and very charismatic speaker. So I highly recommend that. But you do need to donate to the show to get it. $3 a month on Patreon, or starting at $25, a one-time donation on PayPal. And you can do that all through the website, theconversationpod.com. Thank you very much in advance for supporting the show. You can also support the show by following on social media, spreading the word. It's at Artist Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can spread the word. You can let other people know about the show. It's very much appreciated. Maybe you can recommend me to another podcast. A listener to the show who generously donated mentioned an art podcast which I was not familiar with at all. She didn't mention the name of the podcast. It was she mentioned Antrese, A-N-T-R-E-S-E, Wood. Is anybody listen to that podcast? I'd be curious to know if maybe we could have each other on each other's shows, perhaps. All right, so thank you in advance for your support. If you have anything you would like to contribute potentially to a 200th episode of listener-based contributions, that would be great as well. So about the Dana Schutz thing, I have mentioned it briefly in the past, and I just wanted to point you to sort of a final word, if you will, and that can apply if you've already been taking a lot of information about this story of her Emmett Till-based painting in the Whitney Biennial, or if you are pretty much out of the loop on this whole thing. It's a great starting point. It's the Calvin Tompkins profile. It's called Why Dana Schutz Painted Emmett Till. And it ran in the April 10th issue, and it's online, I believe, for free. So you can go check that out. It's a great background on her work, and it all leads up to her making this piece and the controversy that has arisen around it. And I think Calvin Tompkins has some pretty good points about that and how it was interpreted by people who maybe weren't fully clued into the context of the making of the work. A lot of these profiles that Calvin Tompkins does are fine, but they're very forgettable, I find. So this one, I think, he really nailed it by having a profile ongoing, and then this controversy came up. So that's a lot of luck, I would say, right there, that he got to get in on it while he was doing a really intimate, as it were, profile compared to the other pieces, which are much more opinion-based pieces. One last thing before we go, and that is I do have a show that I am curating coming up, all things go to plan, at Charlie James, and just wanted to give you another heads up about that. The opening is May 20th, so we're almost a month away now, and would love to have you Los Angeles-based listeners there. Don't want to have an empty opening. Those are not fun. I'd rather have it be completely devastatingly claustrophobia-inducing packed to have it empty. So would love to see you guys there. I'll give you more details as we get a little closer about who's in the show, but trust me that it's going to be worth checking out. All right. I think that's it for now for this week. Thank you guys for being here. Thank you for listening. I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.